Good morning, everyone, on this foggy Sunday morning in Philadelphia. Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists. We are one of 27 or 28 lodges around the world dedicated to the purpose of universal brotherhood. We are here to spread broadcast the fact that all nature is connected. We are all one. We are all brothers and sisters. And in order to do that, we have two meetings a week. We have the Sunday morning meeting, which the doors open at 10:30. The meeting begins promptly at 11 and closes and ends promptly at 12. We have a reference library, which is open before our Wednesday night meeting, which is on, the doors open at 5:30. The library is open from 5:30 to 7:30. There's a librarian there if you should have any questions. It is a reference library. It's not a lending library. But there are books on other comparative religions, philosophies. There are scientific books, medical. You know, there's quite a bit there to keep you busy. And also the reference for the evening's class, which we are studying in the Ocean of Theosophy. We're on Chapter 8, What Reincarnates. And the meeting begins at 7:45 and ends promptly at 9 p.m. So, as stated earlier, our purpose here is to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy. And in our declaration, the bond is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy. So anyone you see doing anything at the lodge is a volunteer who is independently devoted to the cause of Theosophy. And all of our efforts of time, money, and service are voluntary. There's no implication that one need get involved. One can get involved if they want to. I didn't mention the book table, but now I'll mention that. See someone at the book table before or after the meeting where we have straight line theosophical literature for sale. So the unassailable basis for union among theosophies is then similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. So we have no bylaws, we have no constitution, we have no officers. It's just the similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching of the goodwill offerings of students who's take seriously the philosophy, because the philosophy is here in order to raise the booty manis of the race, which means in order to elevate the thoughts and encourage altruism, which is so sorely needed, and to work from, you know, it's an altruistic purpose. It's, these ideas are sorely needed today in today's world. So without further ado, today's class, two short lectures, hopefully pregnant with lots of ideas that will stimulate answers, that will stimulate questions from the audience. This month, we are doing the path of spiritual evolution. That's the overall topic. We always have an overall umbrella topic. And last week, we had a lecture on the basis of meditation. This week, we have a panel on the care of body and soul. So we will start with the care of the body and then describe the body, and then we will go on to the care of the soul and a description of the soul. The body is the lowest principle. It is our contact with nature and the lower kingdoms, which of which we are stewards, and we are charged with raising up all nature to the path of self-consciousness. Now, self-consciousness is something that only exists in the human kingdom. There is consciousness in all the other kingdoms, which make up our body. The lower kingdoms being the mineral, the vegetable, the animal. And in man, spirit and matter comes to an equilibrium, and we have self-consciousness. We have various degrees of consciousness in the lower kingdoms. All is conscious, all is alive, and all is potentially human, meaning that that is where all evolution heads toward the human stage, and then it's through self-induced and self-devised methods that we advance from there onto other stages. There are higher stages beyond the human. There are perfected humans, the adepts. But we just want to briefly mention that the body is made up of seven principles. We have three higher and four lower. The three higher are permanent principles. That's known as the eternal pilgrim. We have Atma, which is spirit. We have Buddhi, which is spiritual soul. And we have Manas, which is the mind principle, the intellect, that which we use to elevate ourselves or degrade ourselves. And then we have the four lower principles, the quaternary, and that is transitory and lasts but for a lifetime. We have the desire principle. We have the vitality energy. We have the astral body, which is the design body for the human body. And we have the body that we know of. And many people spend far too much time and care and attention to the physical body. But in this talk, we must stress that it is a very important aspect, that it is a very important principle, because proper care of the body will help one in one's life and studies, and will also give one the vitality to be able to go forth and to do any altruistic work that one may desire to engage in. So care of the body is very important. We'll start with diet, because on page 260 of The Key to Theosophy, HPB stresses that earnest students are advised to eat such food as will least clog and weigh down their brains and bodies, and will have the smallest effect in hampering and retarding the development of their intuition, their inner faculties and powers. We believe that much disease, and especially the great predisposition to disease, which is becoming so marked a feature in our time, is very largely due to the eating of meat. Now, there's the whole thing about vegetarianism. Yes, it is the best, and it is the most desired, and it is encouraged in the philosophy. But it is not, if someone who by long habit of eating meat is, they really can't, it has a minor effect on this one transitory life. It will only retard one's progress a little, for after all is said and done, the purely bodily actions and functions are far less important than what a man thinks and feels. What he desires, he encourages in his mind, and allows to take root and grow there. So it is, it's mostly, this chapter, by the way, which deals mostly with vegetarianism, is actually listed as asceticism, because it does cover other aspects as well. But the main thrust of it is the vegetarianism. So, one shouldn't feel too badly if one cannot transcend that diet. Many have tried vegetarianism, and it has been it hasn't worked. We're just, these race bodies are so caught up. So we wanted to mention that, and we also wanted to mention one other thing. That half, if not two-thirds, of our ailings and diseases are the fruit of our imagination and fears. Now, if we can destroy fear, and if we can give another bent to our imagination, nature will do the rest. The body is an incredible, the body and mind and psychic nature, which we're not even going to go into at all in the talk, the body, mind, and psychic nature is one that is so vast and so deep. But if we have the right thoughts, the right feelings, if we have a good imagination, a positive imagination, the body can do incredible things in facilitating one's spiritual path. Go
ahead. I'm done. Okay. And so, we consider our title, I'm sure you came into the room this morning with lots of considerations of your own, and you just heard what it is to be a mind being, be this eternal, invisible being who's acting through visible, impermanent instruments. And with the title, The Care of the Body, we can philosophically say, I have a body. I need to take care of a body. In fact, more accurately, I have instruments and I need to care for the instruments. I need to care about them. But there's another way to view this philosophically, in that as this eternal, invisible being, I am soul. And now the word care becomes more of a noun rather than a verb. What is the care of soul? What is the stewardship, this custodian? If we are soul borrowing all aspects of substance from the universal, from the collective, what should be the care, the altruistic aim behind the pilgrim's path, whatever that may be? The philosophy states that as soul, as human soul, we are perceivers. We share power of awareness, of thought, of will, of feeling, and that we need to purify our use of thought, will, feeling, and have a care for the good of the all, of all a manifestation in the way that we live. So we need to consider what would be the conditions that we would need to free our mind, our soul, as soul, what would we need to have cleared up so that we could exist and exist as compassionate life, exist as eternal, selfless life that would impress everything. How do we become aware as soul? How do we move our minds to pure soul matters so that we've aroused all of those inner powers and faculties? And how do we act carefully with a care that is meditative or mindful or contemplative, however we want to think about that? If you're interested in this kind of process, the care of the soul and how to clear the mind so that soul light can shine through, so that we can move from the heart through the mind to the outer. You might want to revisit the pages of The Voice of the Silence, in which there's descriptors of different aspects we can work on to practice. There are habits of thought, habits of feeling, habits of will that help to allow the radiance of pure spiritual knowledge to shine through. And so we're reminded from The Voice of the Silence that there's charity and harmony in word and act, that patience is an attribute to be perceived and pursued, to be applied, that detachment and meditative life becomes a part of the reality of the day. So as we are now, if we begin to make the attempt to live as soul through these transitory instruments, we can use the rhythms of the day of substance and sustenance to begin to purify the soulful progress, so that we begin to purify instrumentation so that soul wisdom can come through. In the half light of dawn and dusk, we can set up meditative periods in which we're contemplative and we begin to align, harmonize, if you will, the kaleidoscope of all the powers we have, or the symphony of all the powers that we have. So at dawn and dusk, we can set meditation times. Perhaps at times in our daily life when we are taking in sustenance before a meal, or before a good conversation with a like-minded individual or groups of individuals, before a group meeting like this one, there's time when we could retreat from our concentration on the physical and go within and begin to arouse the awareness of calm and detachment and the care that we might bring to the interchange between us and nature, or between us and substance, or between what we perceive as self and the self of others, which we know truly is all one. We might look around and become aware of how others begin to pursue the care of the soul, the altruistic Kuan Yin drive to assist all sentient beings, all entities, to exist beyond just a conditioned experience. And we can become more and more aware that while there's a shared motive, where there might be one path to spiritual life or one path to enlightenment, there are many, many different methods, each depending on the mind of a particular individual, depending on the karma and the skandhas of that individual, the nature of the instrumentations used. But throughout, all of us share the same care, the same concern, that before the soul can see, the harmony within must be attained and fleshly eyes be rendered blind to all illusions. So we need to be extinguishing anger and envy and vanity and fear. We need to begin to fight the illusion of separateness, and begin to turn our use of mind, and as soul become about maintaining the divine in the smallest of tasks, living with a metacognition, if you want, or you could call it making theosophy a living power in life. But very, very gradually beginning the education for soul good, both within and without. We're willing to bet you came with plenty of observations on this very same title.
Go ahead.
You mentioned meat-eating vegetarianism. I haven't seen anywhere in my readings, what do they refer to fish? Besides one stanza in the Bible where Christ helped the fishermen get a buttload of fish. And I always was on a pendulum of about fish, and I can't figure that out.
Well, fish are cold-blooded, and they're not as complex as higher animals are. So it is the most desirable would be fish. If you're going to eat any kind of flesh, fish would be definitely the most desirable thing to eat. But it's really, we need to stress, it's more for the health of the body, of the instrument, but it does not really benefit one. A vegetarian has to study just as hard as a carnivore to get these ideas.
And so much is based on motive.
Yes.
If someone is pursuing vegetarianism from a selfish or self-centered motive, and they're thinking, I'm going to develop perfect scandas so that in my next life, you know, it's going to be thus and so and good for me. Well, for sure, that's not the path to spiritual enlightenment. In the Gita, Krishna's instruction was to find that nourishment that is proper for the body being used in this particular life. And we know there's like a 7-year cycle when the cells of the body turn over, and the needs of the body may change from stage to stage of life. So we're throughout the Gita, we were, and finally, ultimately told, go forth and act as seemest best to thou. You know, do an individual study, look at what the impress might be of taking in flesh meat, a very high level ordered organisms, of organisms that might have been abused or mistreated or genetically modified or whatever. But ultimately, it's an individual study of what is needed to maintain the physical sustenance of the instrument being used. If this body or this astral body is seen as the temple that houses the soul, how might we maintain that body so we can work for others? And motive becomes the big key there.
And we remember reading, and can't remember where, Mr. Judge basically said that we understood him to say that this form in this time period is actually more conducive to eating meat, but then, as was just said by the speaker, it depends on the each individual's form.
Yeah.
Yes.
I read somewhere that an individual who's been a meat eater for much of their lifetime to switch to be a vegetarian is a little difficult, and it's hard on the various systems of the body. It's not the most advantageous thing to do. It's really difficult, and maybe not the healthiest thing to do.
And there's a lot of research that you can do about eat right for your blood type. Looking into vegetarians who need to be very aware of their B12 intake. You know, there's balance and moderation certainly would be key. And indeed, you know, if we've come karmically into this circumstance, whatever this happens to be for each of us as individuated soul, then we're to bloom where we're planted. You know, given what is, it is what it is, and we do the best we can with it.
And it is mostly through long habit, and as we get older, habits are harder to change. So there's that impress that, and there are skandhas involved, those tendencies, those electromagnetic tendencies. So one can still try, or one can just eat less meat if one wants to, or just cut back on the amount. It is eating too much meat is really unhealthy. It is one should eat less if they can, but then again, it all depends on the individual. But excessive anything is unhealthy, so you need to really be honest like what is an excess and what is not? What does my body really need? All our bodies are different. It's a very ticklish subject. There was a hand in the back there. Yes.
My German uncle, who was an anthroposophist and he was not a vegetarian, kept saying, it is worse to think meat than to eat meat.
Oh.
Okay, that's an interesting concept.
My mother was a vegetarian, so there was always this little thing.
You know,
it's like if you constantly crave meat, it's worse than just going ahead and eating.
Over and over again in the reading done for today's topic, there's a lot in that statement, in that many folks, especially here in the West, where you know we want immediate results and immediate gratification, that seems to be the influence of the collective that we're living in. Folks will change outward appearances and outward behaviors and then secretly harbor not only a returning yen for a particular lifestyle or whatever, but they'll even become intensely curious or focused on revisiting that yen and secretly harboring wishful. So it's a hypocritical essence where they're trying to correct the outer transitory instrumentation or habit in the public eye, whereas in the private eye, in the recesses of their own heart and soul, they're still harboring whatever the character defect or motivation is.
Yes, and there's an amazingly descriptive phrase that type of person is known as a false pietist of bewildered soul.
Yeah.
Because it is like you're trying to be holy. It's hypocritical, but one may not realize they're being hypocritical at all. One may really be sincere on the one hand, but they're fighting that habit, that nature, that a strong habit is said to impress one so strongly that it takes three lifetimes to really eradicate. So that's why we should never judge, but especially when we see someone that's involved in a behavior that we may think to ourselves, why don't they just get it, or why don't they stop this, or they could very well be struggling through three lifetimes before it's finally flushed out, as it were. In the back.
But we understand the point made because the word illusion came up, and if we think about it, anything that changes is really illusion. And we're talking about the lower body as was described, the lower four principles. So if this conditioned existence where we find these karmic returns is what we have to work with, we think the point made was if we're spending all our time thinking about that and the needs and wants of that, we're off the point. Because if the intent is to open a pathway to that Buddhi nature, to that higher within us, and sort of honor that through the lower, then even what we're thinking about, concentrating on, ought to be of the higher than of that illusory, changeable condition, lower.
Thank you. And the topic for the month is the path of spiritual evolution. So this is all about evolution. Evolution is something that we need to take in hand. It's not something that just happens. It's an active process. We are mind beings. We have that manas principle, the mind principle, which we can either raise up to that spiritual level of Buddhi, or we can let the demons in and mm-hmm. run wild with our lower desires. And the end of that is annihilation. So the end product of that is annihilation. So we must always be vigilant, ever vigilant, that our evolution is something that we have in our hands. We are powerful beings. The gods are said to be jealous of us because we have this free choice. We have this free will, which we can exhibit. Yes.
You mentioned the astral body, and this season of viruses and everybody getting sick and whatnot. Mm. I always wondered, is it, if a person gets the flu or whatever and is having symptoms of sickness, is it the physical body that's sick and there's no effect on the astral? Or is it first, as we're taught, the astral has to be sick before those symptoms manifest into the physical? Because if the astral body then is the sick one, and I can control the astral body with my mind, and I can actually heal myself. So that's my question. Who comes first? The physical to astral, or astral to physical? And who gets sick?
Well, as we sit here, certainly the spiritual inner core of the eternal is never sick or never handicapped or never challenged. And in truth, for the vast majority of the human race, where we are in evolution right now, that true inner core, that true spirituality, cannot be contacted in our wakeful moment. The astral precedes birth and is. So the notion of our working through a finite, fragmented mind, through this brain controlling the astral body, is something I'd have to do some study on before I agree with it. And certainly virus and bacteria, electricity, these are all physical things on this physical plane that need to be treated on the physical plane. What might be helpful for you or anyone thinking along these lines is the research and the articles that older students have published about the dangers of doing a Christian Science kind of mind healing, where there's an effort made for spirit, mind, power, however you see the eternal, trying to dabble on the physical planes to cure. That kind of process is said to drive physical disease and physical challenge back into the astral. Whereas if they're left on the physical plane, and the internal work is one of, I'm aware of the disease, I will do what I can to care for the body so it can withstand the disease. I am not the body. I am not the disease. If that's where the internal work is, the disease plays itself out on the physical plane and dissipates. If it's drawn back into the spiritual or the astral plane because of mental dabbling with lack of knowledge, then it is internalized, reassimilated, and is not going to be extinguished. Now, that's one person's little study on it. Are there other ways to...
Well, if our astral body is... We understand, like, the idea, not so much, we don't know, but it wouldn't seem that the astral body gets sick, but our thoughts and emotions, which we understand are very much a function of, you know, our mind, our thinking, our mm-hmm. desires, our emotions. If it's way off balance, that sets up certain conditions in our physical bodies.
Right.
So it's not that we do something physically with our physical bodies that gets us physically sick, which can be the case if we just eat too much sugar. That can just put us right into a condition. But the way that we think, and if we allow stresses to get to us, et cetera, those
quote unquote non-physical things that we do can set up the conditions in the physical body to get sick. Mm-hmm. So, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the astral's sick, but how we use our
the instrumentation.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm a healer, and yesterday on Facebook came up a quote by Blavatsky that there is no accident, there is no misshapen day that happened just out of nowhere, that everything was predetermined whether in our current life or in our previous lives. And our illnesses caused by lack of strong immune, they manifest first on an astral body. And when I work with people, I can see illnesses that they don't have at all. No work, no analysis, no MRI, nothing can distinguish. But I see that they're heading in that direction. I see that this person with her mindset is going toward cancer. Unless it turns away from it, it doesn't matter whether in 6 months or in 18 months it will be diagnosed with cancer, unless it changes the way it thinks and works and lives. And our collective consciousness brings those viruses, brings those epidemics, pandemics, and so forth.
Thank you for your contribution.
Yeah.
And we were just thinking, as a child of a parent with Parkinson's, there are levels of dis-ease in the body. Certainly comparing it to a cold or the flu is not appropriate. But whatever the expression is, we think that one of the points made was karmically, this is a return to us, but it mm-hmm. has been exhausted except
yes.
on the physical plane.
Mm-hmm.
So there is merit to trying to just get through it, because it may not be we who have to learn everything from the situation, but perhaps those around us. And if we don't take the time and thoughtfully decide how we will live through this karmic event, or how we will, in our attitude, deal with, you know, we can be the, oh God, why me? Or we can be, okay, how am I going to get through today? What good things can I set up?
Mm-hmm.
So there's benefit in struggling through those things that manifest on the physical plane. And the discussion I had with my father, just a personal input here, when I explained that principle of theosophy to him, that this particular thing will never be back, this is the last expression of it, the hope that was engendered in just the way he looked at me was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
There's different ways to come at it.
And if indeed we are mind beings linking heaven and earth, if you will, spirit and matter, we're the unfolding of deity, the key to soul knowledge is not dependence on another individual or another condition in the external, but the gradual changing so that we are meditating within our own heart. We are contemplating the signals that life are giving us, and then sitting and considering, pondering, concentrating on how to do better, considering how to turn mine away from hopelessness or stress or tension or selfishness, carelessness, where we're abusing the physical instruments we're using, and turn the use of our mind and powers back to a more temperate existence, a more moderate existence, if you will, something based on faith and hope and charity. We become less and less toxic in our thinking, less and less dense in our heart, and therefore more and more open to the spiritual voice of the silence within. Across many lives, If that is the eternal, invisible bond that we hold, we begin to live and radiate that and assist all in life around us. But if we continue to contract and try to be concerned with the transitory and the immediate, just I, me, my, or this particular life or this particular experience, that's when we run into more and more of a dense nature of the duality of life.
This gentleman with the glasses.
Yes. That reminds me that often our outlook on illnesses needs to be altered, because we have a general tendency to see illnesses as only in a negative light. And I'm reminded of Muhammad Ali, famous world champion, who suffers from Parkinson's, and during one of his outings, some fans were expressing how sad it was to see him in the condition he was in. And he was supposed to have responded to them, "Don't feel sorry for me. This is a blessing from God. I've spent my whole life in front of the world, always putting out, God gave me this so that I could sit and go inside myself and discover that world." So it's your perspective on how things are, what's good and what's bad, what is the purpose of it.
Yes, all efforts, all efforts of doctors to help the body facilitate the cleansing and the passing on of the diseases, you know, well, we just wanted to read this one quote here. Most people do not know medicine, they believe in it. It is a sort of faith. Faith in the doctor's ability to heal is essential to healing. The patient must be relieved, encouraged, and cured. So it's difficult to find a good doctor, we think. It can be. Because really, we need to have faith in the doctor's ability to cure, or anyone's ability to cure. If we don't, there's a blockage. If we're too skeptical, then what's the point? This man had his hand up.
Just an observation from what we were saying earlier, where, you know, perhaps it's that the conditions are set up in the astral so that eventually the physical gets sick. And then there was a contribution where a seer actually can see those conditions before they manifest in the physical, and the person may have time to make certain changes before it comes. What that reminded us of is which was mentioned in this room some months ago, is that Penn has, and perhaps other institutions, have developed certain equipment that is so sensitive that it can read the vibrations mm-hmm. off your physical body from a distance of a foot or more, and identify sicknesses, etc., that mm-hmm. are on their way but haven't manifested. So mm-hmm. it's in the astral. It's metaphysical, it would seem, before it's physical, it's metaphysical. And if we're sensitive and intuitive enough to recognize it within ourselves, maybe, and make the necessary changes for mm-hmm. all the right reasons, then things, you know, the karma may work out yeah. different if we're aware enough.
Your description of becoming aware, of being independent, of doing things for ourselves, of doing research and getting as much advice as we can, and then making those mental and spiritual, soulful changes, needs also to be accompanied by a calm, patient detachment that we're going to move through an experience, do the best we can, but why? Is it to maintain the physical health and beauty of a particular instrument, or is the why so that we're better able to serve the lives that we touch and use, or to serve the rights of someone else. And only we can look in our heart of hearts and make that determination.
Yes.
I'm a little confused because Judge Blavatsky and others clearly state that nothing manifests here in the physical plane unless it is first created or manifested in the higher planes. So when a person is sick, obviously, as has been stated numerous times, that has been manifested earlier in the higher planes. My interest is the other aspect where we say, well, mind is the builder, mind is the healer. So my mind is here as far as I know it. It may be someplace else, I just don't know that. But so I'm interested in healing. So there's a person that has gotten the flu and is sick as a dog. And I want to know what is it that I can do, despite what has already been manifested, karmically or not, I don't care, in the higher planes. I want to know what is it that my mind can do to heal, okay, whether myself or whatever. So I don't see this as dabbling in some esoteric, you know, goop that's dangerous, because I'm hearing two opposite statements. One is, well, it's been manifested already, so you're going to get sick. And now, the second statement here, well, my mind's the builder. I can heal myself.
Well, sorry, we must not be communicating well. What is pre-manifested is our use of thought, feeling, will, and our use of substance. So that, frankly, what comes to mind is an individual that I know who had for many, many, many years has worked in an auto body shop and willfully not taken precautions against chemical uses, who has worked 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for 50 years, who smokes cigarettes and drinks coffee and has not followed nutrition, and who at some point in the last 5 years or so has begun to question, what the hell is am I doing and why am I pursuing this money and now I'm losing my health, you know, that whole moral cycle. And still, even with the new considerations of health and am I helping my family, placed himself in a circumstance where he, with a debilitated immune system, worked with two other people who had active flu cases because they needed enough money because they were all going to take a vacation next week. So now they all swapped this flu germ. The repair job did not get done. The money's not going to be there, and they're not well enough to go on their vacation. And what I'm left observing and pondering is, do we even have to worry about the astral in that circumstance? The flu is, that is a virus or a bacteria or whatever it is that has a life of its own. But the individuals that I observed moving through this experience, through their willful misuse of previous substance, set themselves up to get something. And now at this stage, could there be a healer? Could there be a self-described guru of some kind who could step in and make the flu go away? Or is it a karmic thing where they've got the flu, they're living with it? Those of us that can bring good nutrition and vitamins and fresh water and maybe help scrub a house or in some way scrub the office or the tools used or whatever. Those are ways we can alleviate it and make sure that they're in rest, they're not spreading it. Those are all things that we work on the mind level, on the heart level. We figure out what we can do as best we can to ameliorate, but ultimately speaking, the others are in control. And we can help to prevent, or we can give advice, but are we to take away the circumstances of somebody else's karma, or should we even do that? I don't know. I'm not spiritually developed enough to make it a judgment.
There's been a hand all the way in the back on the bench, striped shirt. No?
No.
There was a hand.
There's a hand over
there. Okay.
Is it possible for us to talk about care of the soul? Is it possible to take the position of our spiritual self and take the position of the inner man, the invisible inner man, sort of act as if we are the inner man on a daily basis? If we are to practice this, is it doable? Would this help us to maybe become less materialistic? Would this help us with the care of the body? Mm-hmm. Is that a practical thing to practice daily?
If we know that as we are here, as individuated soul, we are experiencing an incredible array of thoughts and feelings and motives and habits, and this is only just one peekaboo lifetime. There's so many different philosophies and schools of thought of turning to just take a segment of time, just turn to focus, to live in the present. So if we begin that education for the soul and we care about life in general, we begin it at dawn with a period of contemplation of however we can trigger our use of instruments to, as was talked about last Sunday, to meditate, set a tone for the day. And then if we can periodically throughout the day turn our minds back to compassionate living and a mindful re-expression of our goal for the day. And even if it's to, I'm going to act as if soul is eternal. What would that be like? How would my thinking begin to change? And so if we think about the foods we're taking in and the ideas we're taking in and the influences we're giving out, we might say a lot calmer, very, very aware of the pain of another. We may know very well in our heart of hearts that we're really concerned about the dis-ease or the disease of another, but by being calm and patient, we may be able to find just the right phraseology to help assist the other feel better in the moment, or just the right idea that we've read somewhere or we've heard somewhere to offer so that they themselves can become aware. And if we do that consistently, isn't that a very gradual practice that begins to increase capacity and increase our scope of concern for others and for the benefit of all?
Yes, and we wanted to iterate again the fact that half, if not two-thirds, of our illnesses come from our imaginations and fears. And it's, you know, there's so many neuroses out there that are, if we can just do these calming practices, these centering practices, realizing that we're just one incarnation. We're eternal, but we're right here in the moment and now, and nothing can really harm the real man. No harm can come to the real man. We will, this body may perish, but we exist. We eternally exist, and we're eternally occupying body after body and plane after plane of consciousness that, you know, we eternally are. Yes.
Well, from the discussion, we see that it's about the food we eat and the conditions under which we suffer from sickness. But if we go back to war, and most of us, and many of us have had that experience, in boot camp or in our training session, meat was the top of the list. Plenty of it, high protein foods and so forth. However, in the wounded we have Ensure today, and everybody knows what Ensure is, but it is not new. In the hospital, military hospital, it was considered a very important, tasty, and wished for compound, especially if a man has lost an arm and lost a leg. So the idea here is that if you are a soldier, you better eat meat. And if you are a priest or a family member who is retired and so forth, then you reduce it. And the food of vegetarian food is peaceful, calm. But if you're a boxer, a military man, or a man that does physical work, man or woman, you need that high energy. So it's a matter of caste, the type of foods that are beneficial for performing our duty in society.
Okay. Yes.
Hearing that last comment, might that be one of the sources of the problems in our society? The high energy food has made us competitive and not cooperative, made us aggressive and not passive, has made us enemies to one another and not brothers to one another. Could that possibly have some foundation in the large consumption of protein and meat products?
Well, that's one possibility. It was only for the warrior caste, the Kshatriya, that really ate the meat, because India is a vegetarian country. So it was just for the warriors, the warrior caste. But Krishna came from the warrior caste. So that's why it's said, we should watch judging others whether they eat meat or not.
There's also, in Theosophical Movement, this would have been October 2012, there's an article called Learning from the School of Nature, and it gives a wonderful little summary of chapter 17 of the Gita. And it may be that all of us concerned about this particular issue of the alignment of soul and astral and physical and what practices, what care could be taken, we might want to go back to chapter 17 of the Gita. The advice in that chapter is that a person must first purify his faith, and then two, define for himself clearly the object of his worship, remembering that where your treasure is, there will be your heart also. So the third step after renewing faith and considering faith and determining motive and what we treasure and hold so dear, ethic development, then comes be selective of his food so that only foods and drinks are taken which are congenial to his new way of life. And then to understand and live up to the true meaning of sacrifice, of charity, of chastity, of rectitude, asceticism, etc., etc., etc. So there's a lot of contemplative work, a lot of awareness of self, the true nature of self, the true nature of motive, and these outward practices are such that they are key. We do impress all of life with how we act, but it is a matter of individual conscience and retuning and fine-tuning that conscience until finally it's in harmony, it's synthetic with the needs of the whole. So we begin in a process, acting as if, perhaps being a bit self-centered or selfish, gradually retuning thought and will and feeling, the invisible permanent aspects of life, to a self-centered, so I can serve attitude, until it finally blooms in a selfless application of life and existence.
Well, thank you all for coming and for your contributions. Our meeting is adjourned.
Do we take everything?
I take it out and I unplug it, and then I also make sure that I...